and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, public opposition to the Republican tax bill continues to mount as the House passes the bill and the Senate schedules its final vote. Next, in the wake of a deadly train derailment in Washington state, public attention is turning again to the sorry state of America's infrastructure. Why can't Congress agree that the richest country in the world should have the best roads, bridges, airports, and transportation system? Then, Charlottesville Police Chief Alfred Thomas resigned yesterday in the wake of a scathing report about his handling of a white supremacist rally in August. And then Cyril Ramaphosa, a former communist miners union leader who became the richest black man in South Africa, was elected president of the African National Congress, defeating South African President Jacob Zuma's ex-wife. And finally, Don Blankenship, the former Massey Energy CEO, has announced his candidacy for U.S. Senate from West Virginia. Massey went to prison for conspiracy to violate mine safety and health standards after an explosion in one of his mines killed 29 people in 2010. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to taxes. Public opposition to the Republican tax bill continues to mount as the House and Senate schedule their final votes. The House will likely vote on the measure today. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Ted, welcome back. It's always good to have you.
Likewise, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Ted, many of us thought that the language on this or in this tax bill had been settled at the end of last week, but we continue to hear in the press about changes that are being made to attract these final straggler votes, especially in the House of Representatives. Can you tell us what kind of changes we're looking at here? Are any of these changes significant? And will they affect any of us regular Americans?
Well, no. Let's answer the last question first. They're not going to much affect ordinary Americans, at least not in a positive way. There was a provision that seems to have won over Bob Corker, who is not a big fan of President Trump's and seem to have been an outlier and possibly might have been to the tax bill what John McCain was to the attempt to repeal Obamacare. He might have been the killer vote, or at least a one breakaway vote for the Republicans. But he got a provision that appears to may have been a quid pro quo. The Republicans are denying that. That's a big windfall for the real estate business, in which he's invested quite heavily. Just as an aside, I think most Americans would be pretty surprised to know the average net wealth of a U.S. senator. These guys aren't just comfortable. Many of them are spectacularly wealthy individuals and some very successful businessmen. So there's been a lot of that kind of horse trading going on to get these votes. The Republicans are desperate to get a win in their column, although I'm sure we'll talk about whether passing this qualifies as a win, considering how incredibly unpopular this bill is. One of the major takeaways from this past weekend's reading that really struck me was that even among Americans who stand to get a tax benefit, albeit relatively a small one, over the next few years under the Republican tax bill, even they oppose the bill. They think that they're going to get screwed. So the Republican messaging has been almost as bad as the actual content of the legislation, which is pretty damn atrocious.
You know, that's true, Brian. The latest poll that came out today, a CNN poll, shows that fully 55% of Americans don't want to see this tax bill become law. 55% of Americans. You've got a tax bill that caps home mortgage deductions at $750,000, but more importantly, affecting more Americans, the bill as it exists now, and which will likely go to vote in both the House and the Senate, caps at $10,000 the amount of state and local taxes that you can deduct, including your property tax and your state income taxes. That will likely affect almost every middle class American in the country.
That is true. It's a redistribution of wealth
not just from the poor to the rich. It's also from the middle class, including the people who are comfortably middle class.
That's right.
There's a lot of wealth transfer. A lot of the wealth transfer, though, for it looks like it's going to be in California, in New York, in Washington, D.C. You've made the point that it's kind of that part of the middle class that, because of the cost of living, are more or less located on the coast, more or less in traditionally blue states.
That's right.
So I don't know if that's a calculation or not.
Well, it has the practical effect of being the same, having the same impact as if it were a calculation, even if it wasn't. I suspect it probably was. I think that once the Capitol Hill analysts go to roll up their sleeves and go to work, they work on extremely sophisticated metrics these days. It's not like the old days. You know, these guys have a lot of computing power at their beck and call to come up with this legislation. So I think they're well aware of the fact that this is a screw the New Jersey suburbs vote. This is a screw the DC suburbs vote. This is anyone who lives in a state with high local and state taxes is going to lose that federal deduction. And it can mean a lot. It could cost people thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars a year on incomes that aren't that high.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm looking at a piece, Ted, on Bloomberg Politics. They've got this hour by hour update on what's happening with the bill. And Speaker Paul Ryan said at noon today that he has, quote, no concerns whatsoever, unquote, about the unpopularity of this bill, that Americans don't know what's good for them, but Paul Ryan is going to tell them.
But wait, that's Paul Ryan, who as a college student was dreaming while he was drinking beer kegs about taking people's Medicare away.
Right.
I mean, these are bizarre individuals. I mean, anyway, your response, Mr. Rawl?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, anyone who favors the Eddie Munster hairstyle is someone you always have to wonder about. And the thing about Paul, I mean, I mean, to be charitable here and give the devil its due, you know, the Democrats didn't exactly pass a terribly popular piece of legislation when they passed Obamacare. It has become more popular over time. And perhaps that's the kind of calculus that the Capitol Hill Republicans have in mind with this tax bill. But I don't think that's likely to be the case. You know, one thought that I had that I haven't heard a lot of people say is, you know, the reason that I think so many Americans are not down with this trickle-down economics approach, which has been, which was revived under the George W. Bush administration, and obviously goes back to Reagan, is that they have seen this before. Many older Americans remember the 1986 Tax Reform Act. Certainly. You don't have to be that old to remember what George W. Bush did with those ridiculous $300 checks that we all got, while the wealthy and the corporations were making out like bandits. And everyone's well aware of the widening disparity between rich and poor in the United States, and they're feeling it. You know, it's something that we used to have to educate people about. I think now everyone knows, and I think that's the messaging problem the Republicans have.
You know, one of the economics theories that's being presented by the Republicans and by Trump is that by lowering the corporate tax rate and then eventually declaring a tax holiday so that corporations can come back and be rewarded for not having paid taxes by paying at a lower tax rate. Ted, well, if that were to happen, and it will happen now, I mean, what happens to that money? It would seem to me that if the corporations come back and they get this big tax holiday and they get to have like excessive amounts of cash, they're going to use that money to buy back their own stock. They're going to give some investors a reward on dividend. They're not going to be necessarily or probably even investing in that money so that new jobs are created. It seems to me that the whole economic theory is, in fact, just BS, just bad sociology.
Well, I mean, there's been numerous studies that back up entirely what you say, Brian. I mean, obviously, trickle-down economics did not work in the 1980s, and there was a better argument for it back then when there were a lot of businesses that were not awash in cash. That's not the case now. A lot of corporations are sitting on top of vast reserves of wealth that they have excess capital, if anything. There have been stories about banks, like I remember Chase was charging granting negative interest to large deposits because they had excessive cash. So in other words, it would cost you perhaps half a point or 1 point to store your $1 billion at Chase. So they're literally charging you a fee to keep it. It was cheaper to keep it under your mattress for you. The banks don't need cash. The big corporations don't need cash. Lending is not easy for individuals like us, thanks to Dodd-Frank, but companies have access to a lot of cash these days. So there's not a lot of business and hiring that's not getting done due to a lack of capital or access to capital. And I think that's the theory.
It's very interesting. It's really what we're experiencing, what working folks are experiencing with wage stagnation or not real employment. It's not the problem of job loss or job scarcity per se. It's really a system whereby a surplus is dominant, and those who control the surplus, those who have all of the surplus cash, because there's no strings attached, no accountability, they can do with it whatever they want to do. If they invest and produce more products that might not be sold in the marketplace, they won't do that. They'll do other things with their money, like speculate, like buy a lot of Bitcoin, like play the stock market, which is going through the roof.
Well, because we're not a country that makes things anymore. We're an arbitrage nation. And the whole theory is it's really a mid-20th century theory for a 21st century world.
All right. That's all the time we have. We've been joined by editorial cartoonist Ted Rawl. We've been talking to Ted from New York about the Republican tax plan, Robin Hood in reverse. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In the wake of a deadly train derailment in Washington state, public attention is turning again to the sorry state of America's infrastructure. Why can't Congress agree that the richest country in the world should have the best roads, bridges, airports, and transportation system? We're joined from Boston by Andrew Herman. He is the former president of the American Society of Civil Engineers and the current president of the ASCE's Structural Engineering Institute. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Good to be on.
So the attention of the public is again riveted on a tragic accident, the derailment of the train in Washington state. These types of accidents happen over and over and over again. And of course, it's not just rail. It's not just transportation, even. It's a lot of the country's infrastructure. What's going on? What's the problem?
Well, before I start making comments on that, I'd just like to say on behalf of ASCE, I'd like to offer the condolences to the victims and their families of this derailment. But one of the things that ASCE does do is we look at the nation's infrastructure every 4 years, and we actually give them a report card. We look at 16 different categories of infrastructure, and we give them an A through F grade. And 2017 was our last report card, and unfortunately, we had 12 Ds, 3 Cs, and 1 B, and ironically, that B was rail.
Wow. So let's go piece by piece on the infrastructure. Of course, President Trump has said, and taking advantage, I guess, in a way, of what happened in Washington to announce a new infrastructure program was coming and it would make the country a great deal better. But let's talk about some of the different features or the elements of infrastructure. Let's start with the bridges. When I'm doing a Google search, the numbers are kind of staggering. 55,000 bus bridges are in need of repair. Or 68,000 bridges. You know, it varies, but it's like in the tens of thousands of bridges. How badly sort of degraded are the bridges in this country, and what needs to be done with them?
Well, it's interesting. That number you just stated, that I think it's 50 or 60,000 bridges, that's out of 600,000+ highway bridges in the country. So it's about 9% of our bridges are classified as structurally deficient. Now, luckily in the United States, we have a biennial bridge program, which means that every highway bridge in the country has to be inspected at least every 2 years. And if they find anything, they can increase that frequency. They can close the bridge. They can post it for loads. So the departments of transportation are watching our bridges very closely.
There was the dramatic bridge collapse on Interstate 35W over the Mississippi River in downtown Minneapolis. I can't remember the number of people who were hurt or killed.
I think it's 13 killed and 145 injured.
I mean, very dramatic. We don't see that kind of drama, but it could happen to a lot of those bridges if they're in that state of disrepair.
Well, it's interesting because that I-35 bridge was under reconstruction when it did collapse. And they did have some members that were deficient. They found out they were deficient, the gusset plates going back to the original design, but they did last 40 to 50 years. And they also had construction loading. But we rarely see collapses of this magnitude in the United States. And that is because the bridges are inspected so frequently.
And so it's of course, a life or death question of safety for the public, but it's also an economic issue. In terms of the economic effects of having good infrastructure, the economic drawbacks of having poor infrastructure, well, we'll just explain what those are, if you would.
Sure. When we come out with our report card, we give the grades, and we had all those Ds and a couple Cs and one B. But the other thing we said is, well, how much do we need to invest? And we went through it and looked at the numbers and found out that over the next 10 years, we need $2 trillion. We're short that amount. We're actually spending about half of what we need to spend. But we have a deficit of about $2 trillion through 2025. And if you look at that, that does have an economic effect on our economy. Not investing that $2 trillion over 10 years results in $3.9 trillion in lost GDP by 2025, $7 trillion in lost business sales by 2025. So that's an investment of $2 trillion, yet you're losing, and if you don't make the investment, you're losing $3.9 trillion in GDP and $7 trillion in lost business. And you lose 2.5 million jobs in 2025. So it definitely has an economic effect of not investing in our infrastructure.
We're joined from Boston by Andrew Herman. He is a former president of the American Society of Civil Engineers and the current president of the ASCE Structural Engineering Institute. Andy Herman, given the numbers that you just cited, the fact that this obviously would be good for the economy, what's the holdup? What's the failure here to do what's necessary, not only for public safety, but for economic reasons?
We are really baffled because this would be something that could bring our governments together, both the state and the federal governments, to invest for the betterment of our infrastructure, our lifestyle, our economy. And it's actually a payback. I mean, making that investment of $2 trillion over the 10 years actually pays back multitudes more than what they're actually investing. It's a lack of political will. It's a fear that if they invest in infrastructure, they may not get reelected. I just don't understand that because a number of states have raised their gas tax across the country, and it hasn't resulted in loss of the people who pass that.
Yeah, I wonder if there's also an ideological element here because there are consistent attacks against what's called big government spending. That doesn't apply to the Pentagon or to the intelligence agencies, but it does apply to almost everything else, and sort of a hostility towards big government or big government spending. Obviously, infrastructure, even if it's within states, much of it is interstate. Much of what we do in one state impacts on what happens on the next state. I mean, we're an integrated whole here. Is that part of it that the government or some political forces, I would say in particular, more conservative political forces, are just opposed to government spending on almost anything, perhaps with the exception of the military?
It seems to be that way, but if we're looking at the categories of infrastructure across the U.S., we have a lot of big infrastructure items. I mean, dams, we have bridges across all the states, we're talking about energy, inland waterways, levees, ports. These are things that affect the whole country. And that's something that we should be investing in as a country.
In a historical sense, when did the neglect of the country's infrastructure begin? I mean, is this sort of been a permanent problem throughout U.S. history, or are there sort of definite periods where this became more of an issue than others?
We've had a number of investments throughout our history into infrastructure, from canals being built to the, just think about the 1950s when we had the interstate highway system being built. We made the investment. We actually put a funding mechanism in place, the Highway Trust Fund, to pay for that. And it has really worked for our country. We've tied the whole country together. We made it easier to move goods and products and people across the country.
Andy Herman, I want to ask you about Donald Trump's proposed or suggested, it's still vague, infrastructure program. I'm guessing that what he's really talking about is a private, what's called private-public partnership, which is basically privatizing part of the infrastructure. I know this has been happening for some of the very degraded water systems, like the Bayonne, New Jersey is a one that's become very famous or infamous now. The water pipes were old, the people didn't get good water. Corporations came in and made a partnership with the city because the city didn't have the funds. And then people's water rates went through the roof. And I think something like 20% of the homeowners in Bayonne had to sell their homes because they couldn't pay their water bills. Are we looking at a public-private sort of initiative from Trump? And is that a good thing or a bad thing from your point of view?
At ASE, we look at all types of fundings as needed to improve our infrastructure. And public-private partnerships are just one of those ways to raise funds. But one of the things we have to realize in the United States is that we have to pay for our infrastructure. We've been sitting on it for quite some time. Our grandparents and even our great-grandparents made some investments in our infrastructures, from our water supply systems to our highway systems, that we've been neglecting for decades. And now the cost is coming due. It's going to start costing, and it has started costing more and more to do the rehabilitations we need to keep our infrastructure in a good state of repair. PPPs are one way to start funding, but they're only a part of the number of ways we need to fund our infrastructure.
And we have 1 minute left. The politicians, both in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, of course, even the president, and at the state level, they come and they go. So, you know, they're there. They're supposedly representing us, the people, where they are. But it seems like, once they leave office, they sort of wash their hands of the problem. And yet the problem seems to me to be growing. Is that your feeling?
It is growing. Since we do the report card every 4 years, we're seeing that the number of dollars we need to improve and get our grades up to just a B is increasing. Infrastructure funding used to be bipartisan, but we seem to be getting away from that. And then I really don't understand why, because it does benefit all citizens of the United States. It helps our economy. I mean, those numbers I gave you a little bit earlier about what it would cost economically, if you bring it down to the family level, that's $3,400 a year per family. That if we don't make the investment, it's going to cost our people every year.
Yeah, we need to make that investment. And of course, we have invested in overseas military conflicts. Those cost trillions, the ones in the Middle East. Anyway, the country needs to understand what its priorities are. We've been joined from Boston by Andrew Herman. He is the former president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, the current president of the ASCE Structural Engineering Institute. After a very short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Charlottesville Police Chief Alfred Thomas resigned yesterday in the wake of a scathing report about his handling of a white supremacist rally in August. We're joined in studio by Eugene Puryear. Eugene's the host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, which you can listen to in the Washington, D.C. area on weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eugene, it's always great having you back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And we have to say, Eugene is from Charlottesville, Virginia.
I did not know that.
Oh, indeed, I am. I am. Born and raised.
Born
1986,
better.
Martha Jefferson Hospital.
Even better. Okay. Well, Eugene, Let's start with this resignation. Alfred Thomas. I've got some friends in Charlottesville who tell me that until this this white supremacist rally back in August, he was actually a pretty highly regarded police chief. Is that true?
He was the first black police chief in Charlottesville, which in and of itself, I think, was a major advance and seen by people there. And there's been a process going back prior to even what we saw with the Unite the Right inside of Charlottesville around this issue of how the police should be accountable, whether they should have a review board, what the power should be. They had a commission and the whole nine. And I think he was seen by some as open to some of these new ideas about how the police should be looked at. It actually seemed like the city attorney was more resistant to changes than the police chief. So I think he was seen as almost a changing of the guard in Charlottesville, an old southern town, certainly not as someone who is seen as inflammatory as Timothy Longo, who was the police chief before them, who was, you know, had an aggressive stop and frisk style program and many things like that. He came from Baltimore and used to kind of sort of lord that over the head of people. But we've seen the Baltimore police and who they really are through the Justice Department report. So if you think about that kind of shift, that's sort of, I think, what Charlottesville was moving away from by bringing in Mr. Thomas.
So what went wrong in August? Did decision making just fall apart? How did we end up getting the demonstration, the riot, and then the aftermath that we got?
A lot of criticism has come down on Al Thomas around that. I'm not convinced that it was really him. I think it was perhaps higher up than him, but there was the issue, or there were several issues that were laid out. I believe Heafy is the name of the individual who had done the report, former U.S. attorney. And one of the things that came out was that several officers said that Al Thomas had said, let them fight. It'll make it easier to cause a state of emergency so that they could come in and crack down on the protest. There were other things that said, well, they never even reached out to any other jurisdiction that knew about how to deal with big protests. Apparently, there was no real attempt to coordinate with state police. But that being said, going into the issue and coming out of it, I have always felt that it was someone at a higher level, perhaps Governor Terry McAuliffe, who made this decision, especially given that the state police were also hands off now, that made this decision to hope the two sides would fight, to try to make it seem it's the far left, it's the far right, neither of them are from here, and this is a sign we should take down the temperature on this issue. I think they were hoping that letting the two groups clash would make it easier to politically tamp down the Confederate statue issue, which I think was growing out of control. So certainly, I think Al Thomas deserves taking the heat for clearly not having done anything even remotely adequate in terms of keeping people safe. But I also think that to some degree, he may be a scapegoat here for higher political powers who I believe really played a big role in how things played out on August 12th.
In many ways, Eugene, this was a pivotal moment. The white supremacist fascist group came there. It was the Unite the Right rally. They had tiki torches. They intimidated people. They beat people up. They had weapons. They had semi-automatic weapons. Many people who had come to protest against fascism and against racism and against the Klan and the Nazis, they said that the police, when the demonstrators were being confronted by these armed fascists, just stood there and watched. So the equivalence concept, the equivalence between right and left, was bogus and false. And in fact, perhaps a creation of Terry McAuliffe and the political establishment and the law enforcement establishment in the state of Virginia. We don't know how this will play out. We know that the killer of Heather Heyer had his charges upgraded to first degree murder just last week. But when you look at the big picture, because you're there, you're part of the Black Lives Matter movement, you're part of the anti-racist movement. Did this mark the ascension of the ultra-right, the ascension of the fascists, or was this, in fact, a pivotal point in the other direction? Because we saw right after that, in fact, I was with you the next day in Washington, D.C. You were leading a demonstration. Nobody knew how big it would be when you called it, or a few people called it Sunday morning. 7,000 people came out. It's big. Well, anyway, what's the big takeaway?
I think that's a great point. I think it cul-de-sacked some of these fascist forces. I think one thing we saw, for instance, is many universities grew a spine and started canceling some of these events, or at least placing so many hurdles in front of them that they would certainly be canceled. I think we actually saw Terry McAuliffe, who came into the day with sort of a Trump, there's blame on both sides, on the way out, he clearly put the blame on neo-Nazis and all those from the Unite the Right rally. I think that what we saw from the broader populace was, and this is, I think, the point you're speaking to, there were 3,000 or 4,000 people in Baltimore. There were big demonstrations all around the country. I was getting Facebook messages from people who are from Charlottesville, like I am, throughout that whole week afterwards about how heartened people were to see these things happening and see people rising up. I think that to some degree, the sort of alt-right forces, the Unite the Right, the semi-fascists, the actual fascists, have had to retreat a little bit because of this. Most of their rallies, they're now doing the Traditionalist Workers' Party, which is a major force in the Unite the Right rally, is now doing like flash mob style rallies because they don't want to announce where they are because they're afraid they'll be banned or broken up by progressive people. So I think that certainly it hasn't ended the danger, but what the Unite the Right rally was like, we're finally going to get off 4chan and the internet and get into the streets. Now they're like, ooh, maybe we better go back to the internet because people really do not like us.
It couldn't be an accident that this happened, you know, just 8 months after Donald Trump took office. And of course, Trump, in response, when he didn't have a script in front of him, he said, well, there were very fine people on both sides. Which is, you know, has to be. I think David Duke thanked him.
He did. David Duke very quickly got on Twitter and thanked him. And, you know, I think it's important people check out some of the work that Unicorn Riot has done because they were able to obtain the servers that the Unite the Right rally people were working on, the private servers. And prior to the rally, you have people talking about mowing down protesters with cars. Prior to the rally, you have people posting, what are situations in which I could shoot someone and actually have it be determined as self-defense? And you even had on the Daily Stormer website or someone from the Daily Stormer talk about how they were expecting violence from their side. They are actually saying, well, we're not expecting this to be like the normal situation where the police protect us and a few anarchists get arrested. We think that base stick man and his people are going to show up and beat people with sticks and precipitate violence. So they came with this mentality, while on the other side, it was very clear, even those who came with guns like Redneck Revolt, that they were there strictly to protect people. The overall counter protest was designed strictly to provide a political response and have people who are willing to put their bodies on the line in between the community and these forces. So there really was absolutely no, and the history of both sides show that that was a completely false narrative. And I think Donald Trump showed who he really was. And I think many people who felt like, yeah, this guy as a racist who coddles fascists, who's going to promote the worst type of division in our society, said like, yep, he's exactly who we thought he was.
I think what tripped L. Thomas up was that he had mentioned, according to this 207-page report, he had mentioned to several officers in the control center, let him fight for a little. It'll make it easier for us to declare an unlawful assembly. He later, through his attorney, he later denied ever saying, let him fight. But there were several officers who did say that he told them, let them fight. It may be that one sentence that did him in.
Oh, I think so for sure. I think in classic political fallout mode, the person who has the most inflammatory quote or has done the wildest thing is always the person that gets thrown under the bus. And I think that's what happened here. But it was obvious to me watching it. I was not there, unfortunately, until the aftermath. But being from Charlottesville, when you look at the array of forces and the state police who have their riot police are very close by, the National Guard was not that far away. There were plenty of Charlottesville police in the general area. And I just kept thinking as I'm watching live streams, I'm like, where are the police? Like, this just seems so strange knowing what it is. And then I'm thinking, okay, they're literally just deciding to let that happen. And I think for those of people who are from Charlottesville, people who live there, it was so clear that this was a situation where they could have swooped in at any moment and broken the whole thing up and had a giant police line between people and just chose not to. So I think to put it all on Al Thomas, I'm wondering what's up with the state police. I'm wondering what's going on with the governor's office. I'm wondering who called in the National Guard. I really do believe that a political decision, and of course I have no, this is all anecdotal, but I really do believe that Terry McAuliffe was the real one who decided let's let him fight for political reasons to, I think, try to tamp down the statue issue in the context of the election, and it backfired. And now Al Thomas, because of an indiscreet comment, is the one who's getting the heat for it. But I really think we should keep looking at higher levels and not just let this be swept under the rug, which I think may be what's going on here. There's big, big fallout in Charlottesville from this, and I think they're looking to try to end that right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, one of the sad parts is of this whole scenario is that now that the report is released, there doesn't seem to be any more follow-up in train. We're not seeing a second report, let's say, to look at the National Guard or to look at the state police or even to look at the governor's actions. It looks like politically this is going to be the end of it.
Very much so. And the city council, very unwilling, it seems, to really dig in the way they should.
That's all the time we have. We're talking about the resignation, sudden resignation of Charlottesville Police Chief Alfred Thomas, the first black police chief in Charlottesville, and apparently the only one from the political establishment who's going to be held to account for what actually happened last August. We've been talking to Eugene Puryear. He's the show host of By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Cyril Ramaphosa, a former communist miners' union leader who became the richest black man in South Africa, was elected president of the African National Congress, defeating South African President Jacob Zuma's ex-wife. The election will set the direction of both the party and the country. We're joined by Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and author of many books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Dr. Horn, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, what should we make of this ANC election? It seemed to be quite controversial. Cyril Ramaphosa was a hero of the left. He seems to have become a hero of the right or a hero of the wealthy. What does this augur for the ANC? Any policy changes?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, first of all, if the other candidate had prevailed, the ex-spouse of President Jacob Zuma, it would have been seen as a vote for the status quo and a vote for the corruption for which Mr. Zuma has been accused of. Cyril Ramaphosa is seen in many ways as a reformer, which I'm sure comes as an irony in the sense that, as your comments suggest, he is reputed to be a billionaire. And he was supported by South African business, which has not been a friend of reform. But I think in order to understand South Africa, you need a little historical background. There was a negotiated settlement in 1994 that led to the election of Nelson Mandela. Unlike in neighboring Zimbabwe, the South African military was not defeated militarily. In fact, the heavy lifting militarily was done by Cuban troops who defeated the South African military in southern Angola and northern Namibia, and that set the stage for the negotiated settlement. Not only that, but then the socialist camp began to collapse in 1989, 1990, which led to the freedom of Nelson Mandela in 1990 and the all-party negotiations. And so the correlation of forces going into the elections in 1994 were not very positive. And since that time, the U.S. imperialism has continued to hold a very strong foothold in the South African economy. Having said all that, there have been self-inflicted wounds. And I would say that one of the primary ones was the internal coup that led to the deposing of former President Thabo Mbeki, which led to the rise of Jacob Zuma. Ironically, those who claim to be reformers today helped to sack Thabo Mbeki because Thabo Mbeki was trying to remove Zuma on charges of corruption, which now the reformers say are accurate. There is a lot going on in South Africa that has yet to come out.
Dr. Horn, let's talk about the role of the South African Communist Party in the most recent ANC election. The South African Communist Party was a multinational or multiracial party. It was a major party in alliance with Nelson Mandela and the ANC. Talk about their position in this particular election and whether that party, which is such a historically important force within South African politics, does it have the same position, the same stature? Is it united? Go ahead.
The SACP, the South African Communist Party, was basically supporting Cyril Ramaphosa, interestingly enough. They've had a severe falling out with President Jacob Zuma, even though they were a major force, as noted, in helping to sack the former president Thabo Mbeki in that internal party coup that led to the rise of Jacob Zuma. Now, the SACP is suggesting that it will be running candidates against ANC leaders and political representatives in these upcoming elections, and we shall see how that turns out. But in any case, I think that one of the problems in South Africa, in fact, might be the alliance, although I'm not suggesting that the alliance break down. I'm speaking of an alliance between the South African Communist Party, the African National Congress, and the Congress of South African Trade Unions. What led to the sacking of Thabo Mbeki, in part, was that there would be internal debates within the ANC where all of these forces are represented, and say the SACP and others on the left would lose a debate or lose a vote. But then they got upset with Mbeki because he was basically carrying out ANC policy. ANC is a broad church and includes capitalists, includes communists. And that led to the sacking of Mbeki. So it's probably a healthy development that the SACP now says is going to run candidates against ANC leaders and ANC politicos. And I dare say that the South African Communist Party still has the kind of stature that it has held over the last two decades.
You know, I wonder if what's behind this election, this victory, is something much more basic, and it's economic based. I'm looking at a piece that the Associated Press published today, and they quote an independent political analyst by the name of Daniel Silke. He says, as the party's new leader, Ramaphosa will be seen as attempting to revive prudent policymaking in South Africa and stabilize the creaky ship of the South African economy. I wonder if that's really what it comes down to, that the ANC is so old now. It's 105 years old. It's an important, integral part of daily South African life. Maybe this is really just about economic growth and about South Africa reclaiming its position as an economic powerhouse in the southern part of the continent.
Well, keep in mind that South Africa is a powerhouse in Africa, but it's not a powerhouse globally in the global economy. It has a population of about 55 million, about the same size as the population of Great Britain, but only has an economy about the size of the Netherlands. And in any case, as already noted, the U.S. transnational and other forces of the North Atlantic economy basically dominate the economy. So it's going to take quite a bit of heavy lifting to turn South Africa around. Although I should say, in all fairness, over the last two decades, there has been the provision of water to many communities, particularly amongst Africans that did not have water. There's been a fair amount of building of housing. Certainly, there needs to be more building of schools. Keep in mind that part of the apartheid policy was a kind of compulsory ignorance. That is to say, not educating the African majority because only their hands were needed to perform menial tasks. And so it was a major turnaround to try to turn around that ship of state. And the ANC has done a fair job, but obviously not good enough. And keep in mind that the other parties that are on the scene in South Africa are not necessarily the kinds of parties that your audience would applaud. I'm speaking of the Democratic Alliance, which is seen widely and correctly as a party of a sort of neo-apartheid, even though they defeated the ANC in many of the most recent, a number of the metros of the most recent elections. And then there are the Economic Freedom Fighters, which get single digits at most. The Pan-African Congress of quote, Azania, unquote, which gets single digits as well. And so in some ways, the African National Congress continues to prevail because this electoral competition is so weak.
We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn about the South African election. Dr. Horn, we just have a few minutes left, but I want to go back to something that the point that you made, which I think is really important, that it wasn't a real revolution. It was a revolution of sorts, but it was a negotiated settlement following the collapse of the socialist bloc countries that led to black majority rule, led to Nelson Mandela leaving prison and becoming ascending to the president. I can remember in the late 1970s or early 80s, Kenneth Kaunda, who was then the leader of Zambia, said, when the South African Revolution happens, it's going to make the French Revolution look like a tea party. In other words, it would be such a out and out, full out class war by the majority class, the racial or national division corresponding to the class division. But then as a consequence of a changed world situation, it wasn't a revolution like the French Revolution. It wasn't a thoroughgoing revolution. The class structures largely remained intact. How does that play now in terms of what the dominant class really looks like within South Africa, aside from the political superstructure here?
Well, you are correct. It was a negotiated settlement. If there had been justice in South Africa, there would have been war crimes trials. There would have been massive expropriation of property, not least the land. But then again, when that has taken place, look across the border in neighboring Zimbabwe. Obviously, there has been a sanction slapped on regimes that go in for land reform. So the situation in South Africa is very, very complicated as a result. But having said that, I think that given the present correlation of forces globally, with China in the passing lane and with it trying to enact its One Belt, One Road initiative, which will be pouring capital into the eastern sector of Africa in particular, in the area ranging from Ethiopia down to Port Elizabeth on the Indian Ocean coast of South Africa, I think it's possible to suggest that going forward, there is a possibility for optimism. Now, that's going to depend on the leadership. And once again, the fact that so much of faith is being put in a billionaire, Cyril Ramaphosa, who, after all, as you know, was an executive or a leader of this mining firm that was involved in the shooting down of miners in Marikana just a few years ago. Now, of course, he apologized for that, and I guess we have no choice but to accept this apology. But that does not necessarily inspire confidence, I'm afraid, in his leadership going forward.
I have to agree with you. I'm not really sure what to make of the man, to tell you the truth. From the far left to the far right, it just seems a little bit confusing to me. In any event, we're out of time. We were joined by Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of several books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery, and Jim Crow. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Horn. In the meantime, stay tuned. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Don Blankenship, the former Massey Energy CEO, has announced his candidacy for U.S. Senate from West Virginia. You may remember Massey. He went to prison for conspiracy to violate mine safety and health standards after an explosion in one of his mines killed 29 people in 2010. We're joined from Morgantown, West Virginia, by Travis Booth. He's an organizer with the Morgantown Tenants Union. Travis, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Travis, there are a whole bunch of Republicans running for the Republican nomination to oppose Senator Manchin, the incumbent Democrat. What kind of a chance do you think Don Blankenship has, having just gotten out of prison, having this historic scandal in his background? What kind of chance does he have to win this nomination?
To be quite honest with you, I have a lot of faith that the West Virginian people are going to reject Don Blankenship's nomination campaign. This general sentiment that I've gotten from people in the area, across all the different fields of life, is really just one of complete horror at the idea and prospect of someone as devious and conniving as Don Blankenship actually winning that election. So I think people are going to reject that outright.
Travis, let's talk a little bit about Don Blankenship. Utterly unremorseful for his role in this mine explosion. Even in the immediate aftermath of this thing, he refused to take any responsibility. And indeed, federal authorities worked hard to charge him with felonies. He must have had the best attorneys in West Virginia because he ended up taking a plea only to a misdemeanor and then doing a year in a minimum security federal work camp. His advertisements are running in the D.C. market, which is very, very expensive and only really gets, the southeastern part of West Virginia. Does he really think he can win this thing, or is this Blankenship's attempt to try to rehabilitate his own reputation?
I'm not too certain, to be honest with you. From what I've seen, just to take a little bit of a step back, you mentioned the amount of money that was, being pumped into the campaign. And he was completely acquitted on the felony charges that were leveled against him back during the trial in the wake of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, and only pleaded guilty because I think that they had him on record, attempting to sign off on supposed inspections that never took place in the wake of the actual disaster itself. So not only was he not remorseful in any sense of the word, he actually was using this as a way to, you know, kind of make a political statement. In his time in prison, he actually wrote a memoir where he compared himself to an American political prisoner. You know, I would encourage the listeners to actually read into this because it's absolutely ridiculous. The idea that a coal baron, in any sense of the word, could be a political prisoner in the United States of America, let alone coal fields where the entire government is dominated by the money and political influence and capital of the big business magnates in the area. So yeah, it's really ridiculous that this would even be something, you know, he could think he could win. So I think in that way, he's really looking to just kind of stick it to a system that he feels has, for some reason, unjustly targeted him.
Yeah, you're talking about a 65-page book that he wrote entitled An American Political Prisoner. And in this book, I'm reading from opensecrets.org, in this book, he compared his case to Watergate, saying that the Department of Labor initiated a cover-up on the scale of the Watergate scandal, calls himself a political prisoner. Interestingly enough, over the years, he was a mainstream Republican, donated a lot of money. OpenSecrets.org says he donated $195,200 to Republican candidates and party committees between 1989 and 2014. But he says that the party leadership turned on him when he needed their support the most. And he's working, it looks here, to ally himself with Steve Bannon and to portray himself as something of an outsider candidate. He's also trying to make this race with Manchin about coal. Do you think that the people of West Virginia will vote based on a single issue like coal, even if they're just, if we're just talking about the Republican primary? Is coal that important of a single issue that the people of West Virginia will choose or could choose somebody like Blankenship to represent them?
Well, I think to answer that question, you know, you have to take a step and you look at the mentality of people living here. You know, this is a region which has been dominated by the rule of the coal industry really since the beginning of its foundation as a state, you know, with the collapse of the logging industry. So I think to that end, you know, Don Blankenship is really just kind of an ideological representation of bigger and deeper social processes and circumstances that people are really trying to attach themselves to. So whenever we see, you know, people like Don Blankenship coming to the forefront, it really represents a sense of you know, desperate need for something else to occur within this region. You know, so I think there's a certain fatalism that you have to understand in order to understand why Don Blankenship might actually be seen as a viable candidate. Now, again, I don't think that that's valid. You know, I don't think that that's something that'll actually materialize, but it's easy to understand from the logic of people living here why that would be the case.
We're speaking with Travis Booth. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Travis, if a single coal miner had done something that took the lives of 29 members of the board of directors or the upper crust of Massey Energy, that single coal miner certainly wouldn't have gotten a year in prison. It's a class-based sentence, it would seem to me. And here he is, he's out, and he's running for office, rehabilitating himself. The odious character of what's happened, the irony, of course, is obvious, but the odious character, it must ring deeply with people in West Virginia, especially with the family members who lost loved ones that day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember, you know, when the actual disaster happened. You know, personally, I'm actually from the same county where the disaster occurred. And yeah, I knew friends and family who were losing loved ones. You know, we're talking about people's husbands, their fathers, you know, their brothers. And it was such an emotional event, you know, and struck so deep to the core of the community living there that people were just taken aback. There's been an ideological war waged on working people within this region for years now. You know, people who are familiar with the proud history of union struggles in the region, they know, you know, there is a long lineage of people standing up for working people's rights. So the coal industry has really attempted to crush that all out. But still, even despite that, despite the fact that the industry has really stamped out a lot of that proud lineage, people still are up in arms about this. You know, people, whenever you mention Don Blankenship's name, there's like, man, I wish West Virginia had a death penalty, because if anybody deserved it, it would be a rich coal baron like that. But again, you're totally right. If somebody was, you know, poor or working class and committed some sort of crime along the same lines as this, you know, they'd be ended up in jail at best. You know, at worst, you know, the other people would be calling for their heads in the criminal system today.
John Kiriakou, prison is basically for poor people or working people.
Yeah.
And the death sentence is only for working and poor people. There are no rich. Rich people do not get executed in America.
That's right.
Travis, let me ask you, we have just under 2 minutes. Let's talk a little bit more about West Virginia. You're there. Of course, the opioid crisis is huge. The issue of healthcare, the issue of jobs, the issue of wages. I mean, there's so many of fundamentally and profound issues that are not addressed by the powers that be, by the political elites of either party. We have I read about a lawsuit filed by, I think, some county U.S. attorneys or attorney generals against some of the big pharmaceutical companies because of the opioid crisis. In other words, charging them as being big-time drug dealers. We have 1 minute left. Just talk about what that's like.
Yeah, it's really an epidemic. You know, again, tying it in with this broader theme of coal, you know, the opioid epidemic, you know, the lack of jobs, it all stems from, you know, this systematic, you know, underdevelopment and exploitation of people here within this region. You know, many a times the people who would end up initially addicted to painkillers, you know, would be coming out of the mines. You know, they would hurt their backs, you know, other parts of their body. They would go to the doctor, and in order to make it back to work the next day, they would be prescribed these pills in order to deal with the pain. And that was just simply a class issue for the most part, because had they not had that source of income, you know, I mean, that would have been it. You know, them and their families would have been out of a place to live. There wouldn't be any food. And furthermore, there wouldn't have been any hope for them in the future, you know, as far as achieving a higher education. So I think in order to address these issues, you know, we really had to be looking deeper at what's going on here in order to solve these fundamental economic crises that people were experiencing here in this region and across the United States, for that matter.
Well, thanks for joining us, Travis Booth. Travis is joining us from Morgantown, West Virginia. He's an organizer with the Morgantown Tenants Union. We are out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you like the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear our show every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear it at sputniknews.com, or you can subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, you have to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.